Hello, welcome to the reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, July 20th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the first hour of the reading, and therefore we're going to start on the front page of the Arizona Republic. These are the headlines from the front page. Rare cactus survives the white sage blaze. Data centers tap homes as virtual power plants. And House report says DHS diverted FEMA staff to aid in ICE raids. But we're going to begin with the article with two or three pictures on the front page. Rare cactus survives the white sage blaze. This was written by Shi and Kim for the Arizona Republic. When the White Sage Fire swept the Kaibab Plateau last July, Claire Aslin and her students watched the satellite updates nervously as the flames encroached upon their monitoring sites. A rare, partially buried cactus, the size of a French macaron, grew in the direct line of fire. Barred from checking on the botanical pincushions herself as the fire raged, Aslin grasped for a miracle. Perhaps the highway, US 89A, would intercept the flames before they got too close. Perhaps the heat would pass through quickly and leave behind mostly low-severity burns. Anything to help the paradigm plane cactuses ride out the fire. The Northern Arizona University ecologist said, quote, "I didn't think they would survive," unquote. Well, nearly 3 months later, Aslin finally returned to the fire scar north of the Grand Canyon to assess the damage. It was raining, and rivers of ash thundered over the landscape. A nearby rain gauge had partially melted in the blaze, its plastic body frozen into a wilt. The torched juniper and pinyon stood like wrought iron gates to a world turned cinder gray. But between the rivulets of ash, tiny flecks of green popped into view, the only signs of plant life around. Some of the Paradigm Plains cactus had survived. On the burnt terrain, that smattering of mute green might as well have been neon markers. Aslin said, quote, "I was blown away. They seemed to be doing far better than the things that were around them, which was pretty incredible," unquote. But the journey for the squat survivors is far from over. In a new study, Aslin and her team will monitor the recovery of the Paradigm Plains cactus for up to 3 years after the White Sage Fire. They are concerned about whether it can still sustain pollinators and in turn produce new offspring the next year. Rebooting its life cycle faces another challenge that might be more formidable than the fire itself: drought. The most notable feature of the Paradigm Plains cactus is its puny stature. It belongs to the family of Pedeocactus. Pedeo means childlike in reference to its small size, whose members were threatened by poachers feeding the cactus collection trade. Though not currently endangered, the Paradigm Plains cactus is a sensitive species that is closely monitored by government agencies so that it doesn't end up on the list with its other Pedeocactus cousins. The cactus's small build is its only tip. Like an iceberg, the rest of the plant body hunkers below the surface. Like a mole, the Paradigm Plains cactus can pull itself underground, which it does during the dry season and in the winter. It pokes its head out when monsoon rains inflate its roots, or during the spring to offer its flowers to pollinators. So because of this subterranean lifestyle, Aslin thinks the cactus fared better than its taller neighbors in the White Sage Fire. The tiny turtle cactus grows exclusively on the eastern face of the Kaibab Plateau near the Grand Canyon's north rim. Starting from House Rock Valley, 20 miles east of Marble Canyon, the terrain starts to climb, leaving Sagebrush Stronghold for Ponderosa Kingdom. But halfway up the incline, there among that zone between the two ecosystems, that's where it nestles the Paradigm Plains cactus. They number about 4,000 strong. Now that Paradigm Plains cactus plays an important role in its environment because coming in April, it is the first to flower, decking itself with yellow hearts ringed by tall petals in all shades of ecru. Aslan said, quote, "When those pollinators are first coming out of their nest, this is one of the things that they count on," unquote. So while the disappearance of the cactus would not crash the whole ecosystem, the solitary bees and hoverflies that feed from its blooms would be the first to feel the pains. Given its unique footprint, the cactus makes for a good indicator species for the health of the understory community in the aftermath of the White Sage Fire. Aslan has been monitoring the cactus since 2021. Now she has on hand the baseline data for comparing the effects of white sage on the cactus population and what the benchmark of recovery will look like. 6 parking lot-sized plots on the Kaibab Plateau make up Aslan's study. The goal is to track the life cycle milestones of Paradigm Plains cactuses living there in the years after the fire. Her team will also use the results to make a judgment call on whether this species needs to be repopulated as part of the long-haul recovery efforts from the White Sage Fire. In early July, Aslan traveled to the study site to peek at some of her cactuses just before they disappeared underground. Finding those individuals was no small task. Under the shadows of the charred juniper and pinyon pine groves, the Paradigm Plains cactus is easily the shortest thing around, if they haven't already disappeared underground. Some new grasses have reasserted themselves, making the cactuses even harder to spot. But starting this year, Aslan's team will use high-resolution GPS with centimeter-scale precision to mark the location of individual cactuses in order to make them easier to track over time. Now, according to the post-fire assessment, most of the 59,000 acres in the White Sage Fire burned at low soil severity. The vegetation was harder hit, with certain slopes in mosaic fashion suffering full conifer mortality. Aslan estimates that some 20% of the cactuses in her study sites have perished. Her study sites overall suffered mixed fire severity, and the damage among the cactus population is apparent. The injured had lobes or rings of sickly yellow, and the dead were reminiscent of corn on the cob. But splashes of green among the survivors were a promising sign. But it's unclear how these individuals will fare in the long run. She's also worried about the threat of erosion when the next rain hits, that these underground cactuses might be dislodged. A month and a half ago, Aslan's team made rounds, noting that the survivors flowered as usual per spring, and now Aslan had expected to see some fruit, a sign of successful pollination, but she found none. The definition of post-fire recovery comes in many layers, requiring long-term studies to understand the full picture, and there is that complication. A nearly 30-year mega-drought, it looms in the background. It threatens the rebound of the ecosystem. Tree ring studies have found that the American Southwest has been in its driest stretch since AD 800. The signs of drought have manifested as increasing wildfires, plunging water levels in rivers and lakes, dwindling groundwater supplies, just leaving 91% of the American West in a drought. The last mega-drought to strike the region was in the late 1500s. Researchers point to climate change for throttling the current dry period to a mega-status. Aslan said, quote, "The big question is, what comes back after a fire, if it also has to deal with extreme drought?" Unquote. The search for reproductive success among the Paradise Plains cactus is not over. In the fall, Aslan plans to return for the babies that may have sprouted this season. Fruit production is a water-intensive process, so she suspects that the Paradise Plains cactuses might be taking a hiatus after the tumult of the White Sage Fire and then restart their natural rhythms the following year. But still, she is heartened that more than a handful of cactuses made it through the White Sage Fire, which is a crucial first step. Did they just get lucky? And she said, quote, "I do suspect that they may actually be a little more resilient," unquote. Now, fire is an ecologically important player in Arizona's forest, helping recycle nutrients and prune the understory and spark the germination of seed. But there is a limit to what the Paradise Plains cactus and its fire-adapted community can tolerate. Aslan said, quote, "When you put the two together, so fire being a disturbance and drought being a stress, sometimes that overwhelms what plants are able to do," unquote. And that was the article from the front page of the Arizona Republic entitled, "Rare Cactus Survives the White Sage Blaze." Our next article, "Data Center Tap Homes as Virtual Power Plants." And this article was also written by She and Kim for the Arizona Republic. As a flurry of power-hungry data centers come online, instead of adding more generation facilities, a coalition of home energy companies plans to manage energy demand and existing supply more efficiently through the constellation of devices that are hooked to the grid. During peak energy demand periods, that means sipping from home batteries to boost supply and tweaking the thermostat to trim energy use. The network of these home energy appliances working in concert is called a virtual power plant, because these electronics can collectively free up sizable capacity on the grid as if they were a single power plant. It's a classic case of working smarter, not harder. In late June, Sunrun, Tesla, and Renew Home announced a partnership to set up virtual power plants across the country, leaning on the existing fleet of millions of batteries and smart thermostats that are already on active duty. Now, while virtual power plants are not new, this recent effort differs from previous initiatives in its scale, as well as the customer group that it is meant for. Yeah, data centers. Chip Silberman, Sunrun's Director of Grid Services, Chip said, quote, "We're the three largest players in residential virtual power plants, and we are coming together," unquote. So the national program is now open for business and looking for data center patrons. Dozens to hundreds of virtual power plants are in operation around the country, and in a span of a year, they've been called into action more than 1,000 times. In the summer, Arizona Public Service's Smart Thermostat Program can carve out 160 megawatts on the grid. That's enough to power 25,000 households. Similarly, Salt River Project calls up 67,000 thermostats and home batteries to shed energy demand during times of grid strain. This decentralized energy management strategy has averted blackouts in a pinch, especially during a heat wave when air conditioning units ramp up. But so far, virtual power plants have only had a regional footprint, deployed in times of emergency when extreme weather spikes energy use. There is a growing call to tap virtual power plants as a long-term tool for managing the grid rather than a last-ditch fallback to save it. A recent report by the Electrification Research Group called Rewiring America proposed scaling up virtual power plants to accommodate the throng of hyperscalers scrambling for power. And now that reality is just around the corner. The new wave of virtual power plants, led by home battery companies Tesla and as well as Google-led smart thermostat platform Renew Home, they should free up 16 gigawatts of power on the grid, all without having to add a new device. Silverman said, quote, "We can harness what is already out there today," unquote. According to the calculations, Arizona has 572 megawatts of potential capacity from its 360,000 climate control devices and residential batteries already installed. Mobilizing virtual power plants is one of the fastest solutions to conjure capacity on the grid. Building new physical power plants from scratch takes years, and it's an expensive undertaking. When utilities invest in new infrastructure, they usually raise rates to cover the cost, to the chagrin of the existing customers. To leapfrog ahead of utilities' long interconnection queues, many data centers are opting to build their own backyard generation. Overwhelmingly, their power source of choice is fossil fuels, which has sparked backlash over the pollution that it would bring to local neighborhoods. By contrast, virtual power plants can be executed within months. So while data centers are the intended beneficiaries, homeowners who supply the grid extra power by cutting back on their own use also stand to benefit from their flexibility. In theory, reducing demand during peak times help families save on their utility bill, because that's when energy rates are also the highest. For example, homeowners charge their residential batteries from solar panels or the grid during slump periods, and then they use that stored power in the peak hours of the day without needing to jostle with data centers and other grid users for energy. Households are also compensated for participating. According to Tesla, battery owners receive cash sums of up to $400 per year. Sunrun, which offers subscription plans for its batteries for individuals who cannot afford the upfront purchase cost, said that its customers can save up to several hundred dollars off their lease fees. The exact amount depends on the utility and how much power they will let Sunrun draw. The automated adjustments to power consumption should be too small for households to even notice, Sunrun said. And Silverman said, quote, "This could be a win-win-win for everybody," unquote. Well, even before the data center-driven program, virtual power plants have been well received. Participation is voluntary, but past data has given Silverman confidence that most homeowners will not withdraw and throw off the power availability that energy companies can guarantee their data center clients. Silverman said, quote, "What we find is that the majority of customers are very excited to participate because of the financial rewards that they receive," unquote. One of Sunrun's largest markets runs in Puerto Rico, whose energy infrastructure has been battered by natural disasters in recent years. Twin hurricanes in 2017 racked up $100 billion worth of damage to the grid and caused one of the longest blackouts in U.S. history, with some residents cut off from electricity for over a year. Participants have told Silverman that they welcome the rewards from enrolling in Sunrun's virtual power plant program. For some households, it spells the difference between affording groceries and going into debt simply to keep the lights on. Sunrun and its partners plan to organize virtual power plants in corridors of rapid data center growth. One of these places is Virginia, which has the world's largest concentration of data centers, whose crowd of facilities handles 70% of global internet traffic daily. Arizona, which ranks sixth in the country for the highest facility count, also numbers among the potential target markets. Notably, Sunrun pulled out of Arizona last year. It no longer offers new leases for batteries, though it still services existing customers. Silverman has not ruled out returning to Arizona if the data center growth here explodes. In the future, to expand the virtual power plant footprint, Sunrun said, it would use the money from serving data centers to subsidize deploying new batteries and smart thermostats. Momentum for adding distributed energy resources to accommodate data centers is ticking up elsewhere. According to Canary Media, in early July, New Jersey signed into law the Data Center Fair Share Act, which incentivizes data centers to bankroll home efficiency upgrades in order to get priority in the utility's interconnection queue. Other states, like California and Colorado, are reportedly considering similar legislation. Virtual power plants alone cannot address the full scale of data centers' energy needs, since it only shuffles energy around, granted more efficiently, but it doesn't add new sources. Data centers on American soil use more energy combined than any other country in the world, and that includes China, and that appetite for power is projected to balloon 2 times the current levels in the next 2 years. Nevertheless, supporters say virtual power plants can be an important part of meeting that rising energy demand, one that doesn't require extra investment that raises the cost for everybody. Silverman thinks that distributed energy solutions need to be developed in parallel with generation build-out. He said, quote, people need to understand that they can be part of the solution here. They are not a captive audience for these data centers, unquote. And that was the article, Data Centers Tap Homes as Virtual Power Plants. The last article from the front page of the Arizona Republic was written by Daniel Gonzalez for the Arizona Republic. House report says DHS diverted FEMA staff to aid in ICE raids. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's core mission is to help people during and after disasters. But starting in August 2025, the Department of Homeland Security diverted FEMA staff to use their logistical expertise to help ICE and the Border Patrol carry out a completely different and illegal mission, immigration enforcement. That's according to a new report by House Democrats led by U.S. Representative Greg Stanton of Arizona. The diversion of FEMA staff to assist in the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign, it undermined FEMA's mission of providing federal assistance to people during disasters. What's more, FEMA staff was being diverted to help ICE and the Border Patrol with immigration enforcement and detention at a time when the agency had lost more than 5,000 full-time employees, or about 30% of the overall staff, through a combination of cuts by the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, or non-renewal of contracts for temporary disaster workers, as well as staff losses tied to low morale and forced reassignments. The decision by the Department of Homeland Security, under former Secretary Kristi Noem, to divert FEMA staff to assist ICE with immigration enforcement came after cuts to FEMA weakened the agency's response to that deadly July 4, 2025 flood in the Texas Hill Country. Severe flooding struck overnight during the Independence Day holiday weekend, killing more than 100 people and causing widespread destruction across several counties. The floods were among the deadliest natural disasters in Texas history, the report said. The Guadalupe River rose rapidly, inundating a children's summer camp and the surrounding communities with little warning. In the days after the July 4th flood, FEMA's Disaster Assistance Call Center operations collapsed. A witness said in the report that FEMA's call center operations rely on outsourced contact center contracts to handle call volume, particularly during post-disaster surges. But on July 5, 2025, the contract lapsed after Secretary Noem declined to renew it due to an internal policy requiring her personal review of expenditures that exceeded $100,000. With the contract lapse, FEMA had no contractors available to answer calls. Stanton said in an interview, quote, "The response was terrible by FEMA. That is exactly the opposite of what Americans want and need from this agency." So that's what this report shows, that the decimation of FEMA has been purposeful, and there's illegal actions being taken by deploying FEMA employees for work with ICE and Homeland Security, unquote. The month after FEMA's poor response to the Texas floods, DHS directed FEMA staff to serve as the operational backbone of large-scale immigration enforcement and detention operations. Quote, "A function with no basis in FEMA's statutory mission and without clear legal authority," unquote, from the report. FEMA staff were directed to perform functions including operational planning for arrest, raids, and patrols. They also assisted with processing and logistics for detained non-citizens, recruiting and onboarding ICE officers, and day-to-day management of immigration detention facilities. One witness in the report said, quote, "ICE could not have done this work without FEMA," unquote. During the 2026 hurricane season, which started June 1st and lasts through November, the deployment of FEMA staff for non-humanitarian or for non-disaster missions, along with staff reductions, has hurt the agency's readiness and ability to respond swiftly and efficiently when disaster strikes. The report said, quote, "These issues and setbacks raise grave concerns about the agency's ability to keep Americans safe before, during, and after natural disasters." DHS and FEMA officials did not respond to a request for comment. Stanton said the report was triggered by whistleblowers within FEMA who came forward, quote, "so the American people can know what is happening inside FEMA," unquote. Now, Stanton is the ranking Democrat on the House Transportation Subcommittee on Economic Development, Public Buildings, and Emergency Management, and that subcommittee oversees FEMA. Using the information from whistleblowers, government documents, and other sources, the report reveals the elimination of thousands of FEMA employees through cuts. It also shows how the Department of Homeland Security, under the Trump administration, has deployed hundreds of FEMA employees to ICE. DHS needs to recall all FEMA staff from immigration enforcement details and reimburse FEMA for the amount of time that FEMA staff spent assisting ICE and the Border Patrol, according to the report. Stanton also would like to see FEMA made an independent agency where it would no longer operate at the whim of the Homeland Security Secretary. And that was the article. House report says DHS diverted FEMA staff to aid in ICE raids. We're coming up on 30 minutes past the hour, and we have finished the front page of the Arizona Republic. Let's take a look and see if there's some articles inside the interior of the first section that deal maybe with the Valley and State. This article from around the Valley and State section is entitled "Former ASU President Laddie Kaur Dies at 89." It was written by Helen Rommel for the Arizona Republic. Laddie F. Kaur, the former Arizona State University president, who transformed the state's largest public university from a football factory into a top-tier research institution, died July 16th after a brief illness. He was 89. During Corr's 12-year tenure at ASU, from 1990 to 2002, he guided the university during an era of rapid change across higher education. ASU's research funding grew by nearly 150%, and the school's endowment fund rose to almost $250 million. He oversaw the opening of the Polytechnic campus, ushering in a new era for the multi-campus university. Corr's vision, as described in his inaugural address as president, was to ensure that ASU became a world-class university, unbridled by its past reputation. He wrote in a 2024 book about his life and work, quote, "Done right, ASU will be one of the great universities in America, and I think it's on its way," unquote. And Corr was instrumental in the selection of his successor, ASU President Michael Crow, who continued to expand on Corr's vision of embedding ASU within the Valley and Greater Arizona. Corr also worked to incorporate the state's cultural heritage within ASU, calling it, quote, "one of the most significant historical assets we have," unquote. President Crow said in a statement following his death, quote, "ASU would not be the institution it is today without Laddie Corr's vision, leadership, and commitment to the community." Governor Katie Hobbs described Corr as a true champion. She wrote on social media, "Dr. Laddie Corr dedicated his life to making our state a better place for everyone. His legacy will be felt for generations." To his family, Corr was a father who was always there for his children. His daughter, Farrell Bertman, said, quote, "I could be a five-year-old calling to ask if I could, you know, eat Cap'n Crunch, and he would stop talking to the governor and pick up the phone," unquote. His son Colin said his father was selfless both in how he led the university and in his personal life. He said, quote, "as grand as he was a leader here in Phoenix, he was equally an amazing father for myself and my brother and sister," unquote. Corr had three children and was married to Elva Corr, who died in 2024 at the age of 85. When Corr was named the university's 15th president in 1989, students joked that his name was a natural fit for a school with a party reputation. But Corr made it clear he was not part of the Beer family. There is no S in his name, nor was he fond of the school's party image. During his tenure, enrollment in ASU's Honors College quadrupled, and a five-year capital campaign raised more than $500 million, easily exceeding the goal of just $300 million. He retired as ASU's president in 2002 at the age of 64, but he continued to teach in the university's School of Public Affairs. He also went on to head the nonprofit Center for the Future of Arizona. That was a Phoenix-based educational research nonprofit and think tank. He left that position at the center in 2018. But he did serve as the founding chair emeritus at the time of his death. Laddie Corr was born in Phoenix and raised in Avondale. His father was a public school principal. His mother was a teacher. After earning a bachelor's degree at Northern Arizona University, Corr set out to establish his academic credentials at institutions across the country. As president of the University of Vermont for 14 years, he was known as a determined fundraiser and supporter of the advancement of minority communities. In 2004, ASU named a high-tech, distinctive glass classroom building on the Tempe campus after him. Phoenix architect Eddie Jones said in a 2004 interview that the building was, in a way, quote, all about Laddie Core. When I designed it, I told myself to remember that it's about Laddie Core. That's the theme. It's practical, it's functional, and it doesn't pretend to be anything it is not. Everything about it should contribute to the function of the building. The integrity of Laddie Core is in the integrity of this building, unquote. Crow called that building a fitting testament to his predecessor. He said at the time, quote, the building's grand stature lives up to its namesake. Laddie Core elevated the university's status as a major research institution with high-quality academics and a diverse student body, unquote. In 2006, the Valley Leadership Organization named Core its Man of the Year. Scott Jacobson, the former executive director of Valley Leadership, said in a 2006 interview, he was honored for leaving, quote, an indelible imprint on the course of Arizona's history, unquote. Jacobson called Core unflappable and steadfastly determined with a quiet leadership style. Though he returned to Phoenix in 1990 with distinguished academic and administrative credentials, he was something of an unknown. A quirky selection process raised initial questions about his appointment, but the reservations dissolved as Core displayed his easy confidence and his recipe for academic prestige. He was known as a hands-on administrator who could also delegate his workload. Lynn Phillips worked with Core for more than three decades between her time at ASU and the Center for the Future of Arizona. She mostly recently served as the executive assistant to the President Emeritus. Phillips said she was struck not only by his love for the Grand Canyon State, but also by his dedication to improving it. She recalled his compassion for others and deep cultural appreciation during his many travels. He was an admirer of opera and well-read. She said, quote, he was an adventurer. I can't even describe it. I've never known anybody like that, that had so many interests and talents and passions, unquote. Core was also an avid hiker, birder, bicyclist, his family said. He climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in his late 70s. He and his wife were end-to-end hikers of the over 800-mile Arizona Trail, which stretches from Mexico to Utah. One of Core's proudest moments as president was when ASU earned Carnegie Level 1 research status in 1994. That was very rare for a university without a medical school at the time. The designation made it easier for the university to attract top faculty and students. Core authored a book about his life and service in 2024. It was titled Growing Up in Arizona, Remembering the Past. In it, he expands on his feeling that ASU was underappreciated at that time, saying that it was, is, and remains, quote, the most attractive public university franchise in America, unquote. When he arrived at ASU, Core said he wanted to find the university's main purpose and chart a course for the upcoming decade. Quote, to accomplish this, I prowled the halls of the campus, the corridors of the State House and City Halls, the boardrooms of business and industry, unquote. Well, today, ASU has four full campuses in Arizona and serves nearly 200,000 students annually from more than 165 countries. It is routinely lauded for its commitment to innovation and accessibility by national organizations. And that was the article, Former ASU President Laddie Core Dies at 89. Our next article from the Valley and State section was written by Karina Vanek for the Arizona Republic. Boeing seeks to expand Mesa operations with new facility. Boeing wants to add a 263,000 square foot manufacturing facility to its Mesa campus. That's a project that would more than double the company's existing production space in the city. The project is being called the Boeing Fabrication Center. It would be used for the fabrication of highly specialized carbon military parts, according to documents submitted to the city. The building is planned for 38 acres adjacent to the company's existing facilities near Greenfield and McDowell Roads. Boeing is proposing to build a one-story facility on vacant land owned by the company that has zoning to allow limited manufacturing. The company's existing manufacturing facility is about 159,000 square feet and has about 120 employees per shift, according to city documents. The expansion facility would have 130 employees per shift. Both buildings would operate two shifts daily. A company representative did not respond to a request for comment about the expansion, and the company did not specify what would be manufactured in the expanded facility. However, in late 2025, Boeing announced that it had received a $4.7 billion contract to build 96 Apache attack helicopters, the AH-64E. The Apache attack helicopters for the Polish Armed Forces at its Mesa campus. It is the largest order of Apache aircraft outside of the United States. Christina Upa, vice president of Boeing's attack helicopter program, said in a statement at that time, quote, "This important agreement allows us to begin building one of the largest and most formidable Apache fleets that the world has ever seen," unquote. Deliveries of the helicopters will begin in 2028. And that was Karina Vanek's article, "Boeing Seeks to Expand Mesa Operations with New Facility." At 42 minutes past the hour, our next article is by Stephanie Innes, who's also a reporter for the Arizona Republic. And Stephanie wrote an article entitled, "County Health Officials are investigating a new measles cluster." Uh-oh, measles. Public health officials are investigating a measles cluster linked to a business in the unincorporated Maricopa County community of Aguila, A-G-U-I-L-A. The cluster includes at least 7 confirmed cases. The Maricopa County Department of Public Health said on July 17th, bringing the county's total number of measles cases in 2026 to 21. That is a significantly higher than the annual average of 1 case per year over the past 30 years. County public health officials said they are working with the employer and local partners to respond. Aguila is located along US 60, about 91 miles northwest of downtown Phoenix. Measles is a highly contagious respiratory virus that can linger in the air for up to 2 hours. About 90% of unvaccinated people exposed to the virus will become infected, according to federal, state, and county public health officials. The disease is preventable with 2 doses of the measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, and that's typically given during childhood. People born before 1957 or those who had measles as children are generally considered immune. Some people with measles develop complications, such as ear infections, pneumonia, diarrhea, or encephalitis. That's the inflammation of the brain that can cause permanent brain damage. And in severe cases, measles can lead to hospitalization or death. Maricopa County has now confirmed 21 measles cases in 2026. Health officials said the continued spread underscores the risk of local transmission and the importance of vaccination and recognizing symptoms early. The newly identified measles cluster brings Arizona's total confirmed cases to 117 in 2026. Health officials say the recent increase in measles cases reflects a broader resurgence driven by declining vaccination rates, leaving more communities vulnerable to outbreaks of the highly contagious virus. Maricopa County officials on July 17th released two Phoenix area locations in Tempe and Surprise where the public may have been exposed to someone with measles. The health department would not say whether the two sites were associated with the cluster of cases in Aguila. Now, symptoms of measles typically appear 7 to 12 days after exposure, but they can take up to 21 days. Those symptoms include a rash that is red, raised, and blotchy, a high fever greater than 101 degrees Fahrenheit, red watery eyes, a cough, and a runny nose. Now, the sites that were mentioned were from 5 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on Monday, July 6th, at the Tempe Marketplace, 2000 East Rio Salado Parkway in Tempe. Anyone who was there at that date and time should monitor for symptoms until July 27th. The second site was from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday, July 12th at Walmart, 13770 West Bell Road in Surprise. Anyone who may have been exposed should watch for symptoms through August 2nd. And that was Stephanie Innes' article, County Health Officials Are Investigating a New Measles Cluster. Well, we're coming up on 47 minutes past the hour, so let's take a look and see if there's some articles that might be from around the nation. Oh, here's a couple. Forest Service workers freed after California standoff. Written by David Benda and Jenny Espino for the Reading Record Searchlight. Two U.S. Forest Service employees were rescued unharmed early July 17th after an hours-long hostage standoff in a remote section of Northern California's Shasta Trinity National Forest, according to federal officials. Two suspects, identified as Joseph Henriksen and his son, were taken into custody following a negotiation effort that lasted more than 9 hours and involved local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, including specialized FBI negotiators. The Department of Justice announced on July 17th the suspects in the kidnapping had been arrested, but potential charges had not yet been fully detailed as investigators continued gathering evidence. Officials said additional information about the suspects, the potential charges, and the circumstances behind the kidnapping is expected to be released through the upcoming court proceedings. Now, authorities have not disclosed why the Forest Service employees were targeted or what circumstances initially brought them into contact with the suspects, and they've not publicly identified the employees. The Shasta Trinity National Forest spans more than 2 million acres across Northern California and contains vast stretches of remote terrain where access can be challenging for emergency responders. Authorities say the incident unfolded during the afternoon of July 16th near Gumboot Lake in Siskiyou County, which is a rugged forested area west of Interstate 5 near the Oregon border. The investigation remains active. Officials have released only limited details about what led to the kidnapping or the motive. According to federal officials, it started when law enforcement began negotiations with Joseph Henriksen, who was allegedly holding these two Forest Service employees against their will. The hostages were being held in a trailer in the remote Gumboot Lake area. The location's isolation complicated the response and prompted a multi-agency operation, which involved, the FBI, the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office, the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, and other law enforcement partners. The first hostage was released shortly after 1:30 a.m. on July 17th, according to FBI Special Agent Brian Tosh. A second employee was freed about 15 minutes later. Both workers were reported safe. At about 2:30 a.m., Henriksen and his son exited the trailer and surrendered to authorities, ending the standoff without shots being fired. Quote, the hostages are okay, unquote, a spokesperson for the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office said. During the July 17th news conference, officials said Henriksen was heavily armed during the standoff. Tosh said authorities learned the suspect possessed an AR-15-style rifle and knives and had claimed to possess grenades. Officials have not yet confirmed whether any explosive devices were actually recovered. Siskiyou County Sheriff Jeremiah LaRue said Henriksen had firearms and repeatedly sought to speak with the FBI during negotiations, but authorities declined to elaborate, citing the ongoing investigation. And that was the article, Forest Service Workers Freed After California Standoff. Our next article is entitled, U.S. Responds to Military Deaths with More Attacks, by Nayera Abdallah and Iman Abouhasiri for Reuters News Group. It comes from Dubai. The United States said it had completed an eighth straight night of attacks against Iran after earlier announcing that two U.S. military personnel were killed in Jordan, while U.S. allies in the region reported more Iranian attacks on July 19th. The United States and Iran have intensified attacks as an interim ceasefire deal signed a month ago has unraveled, and a struggle for control of the Strait of Hormuz has deepened, raising the risk of a return to all-out hostilities. Israeli officials said Israel was preparing to receive more U.S. refueling aircraft after the recent escalation and ahead of a possible expansion of U.S. military operations against Iran. U.S. Central Command said the latest airstrikes, beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on July 17th, were designed, quote, to further degrade Iran's ability to threaten commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and swiftly punish Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps forces who launched attacks against American service members in Jordan, unquote. Central Command later said it had completed its wave of attacks, hitting Iranian military coastal surveillance and air defense facilities. The conflict, which began when the United States and Israel launched strikes on Iran on February 28th, hoping to disable its nuclear and missile programs and degrade its regional proxies, has led to major disruption to energy supplies and fears over global inflation. Iranian reports said the United States carried out an attack near Sirik, that's S-I-R-I-K, in southern Iran, and near Shadigan, close to the border with Iraq. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization condemned a U.S. attack on the site of a nuclear power plant that was under construction in Darkhoven, according to Iran's Mir news agency. The International Atomic Energy Agency said it was investigating reports of an overnight attack, noting that the plant was in the very early stages of construction. In response to the latest strikes, Iran carried out a drone attack that targeted U.S. military assets and equipment at Kuwait's Al-Adiri camp and Ali al-Salem Air Base, according to Iranian state TV, which reported this early on July 19th. Kuwait's government said that a desalinization plant was attacked for the second day running, causing a fire. Kuwait's armed forces said earlier they again intercepted Iranian missiles after a sustained attack on July 18th. Bahrain's air defenses also intercepted an Iranian attack on July 19th, according to its state TV. Sirens sounded in Jordan, where the military said it had shot down three Iranian missiles. The Israeli military said it had detected the launch of missiles from Iran toward the Jordanian city of Aqaba on Israel's border. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said on July 19th that four vessels had attempted to transit the strait via an unsafe route with U.S. backing after ignoring IRGC, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It said two had abandoned the attempt while the other two were involved in an accident, but it did not elaborate. Central Command said the deaths of two of its service personnel had occurred on July 17th and that a third U.S. service member was missing in action. Overall, thousands have been killed in the conflict, mainly in Iran and in Lebanon, where a war between Israel and the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah was reignited. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met Lebanese President Joseph Aoun, A-O-U-N, on July 19th to discuss a U.S.-backed framework agreement that was signed in June. And that's the article, U.S. Responds to Military Deaths with More Attacks. Well, before we go, we ought to take a look at today in history into the almanac. On this date, July 20th, in 1881, the Sioux leader, Sitting Bull, surrendered to the U.S. Army at Fort Buford in the Dakota Territory in exchange for amnesty for himself and his people, 5 years after the death of Lieutenant Colonel George Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And then in 1968, 1,000 athletes from the United States and Canada participated in the world's first Special Olympics at Soldier Field in Chicago. And in 1969, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to step foot on the moon. After the successful landing of the lunar module Eagle at the Sea of Tranquility, they exited and made the first walk on the moon, with Armstrong famously saying, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." And that's what happened on today's date in history. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the first hour of the Reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, July 20th, 2026. I hope you have a great day, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye-bye.